Chapter 14. Vision. It would be gratifying to say that we of the Black Legion simply follow a prophecy that assures us all will be well, that our path is preordained, and that victory is inevitable. It would be very gratifying indeed. It would also be a lie. I've always regarded prophecy with great distaste. I loathed it when I first walked the decks of the Vengeful Spirit with Telemachon and Lihor. I loathe it all the more fervently now. Eternity with Asher Kai, Sargon, Zarathustra, and Morianna has done nothing to kindle any reverence in me. No soul is as self-righteous as one that believes it gazes into the future. I reserve my most ardent distaste for Morianna. More than one of Ezekiel's lieutenants has threatened to slaughter his contrary prophetess. Several of them have been executed for trying to make their threats a reality. In one case, I wielded the killing spear myself, stealing a brother's life by the War Master's command. How I burned to turn the blade on Morianna as she looked on, smiling, at Ezekiel's side. I've never forgiven her for that day. I never will. The War Master is no fool. Though he values his seers and soothsayers above many of his other sub-commanders, he has rarely bound the Black Legion's fate to their prophecies. Only a madman heeds the Four Gods' promises as anything more than teasing possibility. The best way to survive living in the eye of terror is to understand the warp. The best way to prosper is to master it. The quickest way to die is to trust it. So we lay claim to no overarching vision guiding our wars of conquest. Foresight is just another weapon in the War Master's arsenal. The night we met Abaddon, where the vengeful spirit was hidden within the crust of a time-lost world, he took us from his pilgrimage museum to where Sargon prayed in the silent stillness of the lower decks. The further we walked, the stronger the smell, for those decks carried the ripe spice of advanced decay with no discernible source. I felt the abattoir stink sinking into my skin. The word-bearer was waiting for us down there in the deeper dark, meditating in a humble isolation cell with nothing but a cold metal pallet for slumber. He was still clad in the crimson of his legion, the ceramite inscribed with layers of Colchisian runic scripture just as before. And just as before, his mind was almost impenetrable to my questing senses. The sight of his face was a revelation in itself. Most warriors of the Nine Legions, and our thin-blooded cousins in the Imperium's shattered Space Marine chapters, possess an ageless quality to their appearance. Our genetics generally preserve us in our physical and soldierly prime, leaving us resembling augmented human males between 3 and 4 decades of age. Beneath Sargon's helm, I'd expected to find a weathered veteran visage, a warrior priest who wore his age and scars with pride. I had not expected this pale youth, whose features seemed barely into adulthood. He looked freshly inducted from his legion's reserve companies, no more than 2 decades of life behind him. Grievous burn scarring ran from his chin down his neck and into the collar of his gorget. A plasma burn. There was the wound that stole his voice. He was lucky it had not severed his head.
"My prophet," Abaddon greeted him. "These men desire answers."
Sargon rose from his knees, greeting us with a familiar gesture in Legiones Astartes battlefield sign language. His fist rested against his heart. Then his hand opened as he offered it towards us, the traditional greeting between loyal brothers, showing proof of no weapon in his grip. Telemachon, to my surprise, returned the gesture. Lihor merely nodded. "Sargon," I said, "do I have you to thank for saving Falcus and his brethren?" His eyes were green, rare for the desert clans of Colchis, who were near uniformly as dusky-skinned as most Tiscans, and shared the same darkness of iris. In answer to my question, he nodded once and offered a small, crooked smile. Legion Battle Sign had no word for sorcery, but he conveyed its meaning well enough by piecing together several other gestures. Another mystery solved. I did not mention that Falcus and his warriors were suffering in the throes of possession. For now, I wanted to be given answers, not to provide them. At the end of his explanation, Sargon looked to Abaddon and tapped a thumb between one of his own eyes.
Yes, said the former First Captain. Show them.
Sargon closed his bright eyes and held his arms to the sides, in imitation of the Catharic's crucified god. I felt the tension rising, no different from the way the air is charged in the moments before a storm breaks. Whatever psychic control he was exerting, I raised my guard against it.
Cease that, I said softly.
When he did not obey, I lifted my hand towards him with a shove of telekinesis. Sargon's eyes snapped open as he staggered 3 steps back, surprise writ across his young features.
Is something wrong, Kion?
Said Abaddon, dryly amused by my resistance. I have seen the future as Ashokai watches it, divine from the entrails of the dead and the blood spatters of the dying. I have stared into scrying pools with my brother Ahriman, and listened to the babbling of gods, ghosts, and demons. I care nothing for prophecy and its endlessly unreliable pathways. Whatever you wish to show me of the future will be of no interest to me, and even less use. Sargon smiled again, that same barely there expression, and made the chopping motion for negative. You do not plan to show us the future, Prophet? Again the same gesture, negative. Then what? Abaddon answered for the silent seer.
The future is unwritten, Kion, because we haven't yet written it. I didn't bring you across the Great Eye to bribe you with the warp's promises of what might come to pass.
Then why did you lure us here?
Because I chose you, fool.
He mastered it well with a smile, but the first taste of temper crept into Abaddon's voice.
I chose all of you.
And why us? I asked. For what purpose? Abaddon nodded to Sargon once more.
That is what he is trying to show you.
We are children, with the ambitions of adults and the knowledge of enlightenment, looking across the City of Light with eyes that have seen nothing of war. The night is hot, the stars are bright. The wind, when it bothers to breathe, cools the season's sweat on our skin. What if they refuse us? The other boy asks me. Then I will be an explorer, I tell him. I will walk the wild lands and be the first to found a new city on Prospero. He isn't reassured. There is only the Legion, Iskander. To be anything else is to fail our people. I summon a glass of water to my hand from across the table, spilling some on the way. Mekari has to reach for his, leaning over the table to get it. I do not comment on it. I sense his jealousy, but do not comment on that either. We are no longer children. We are men with guns that kick in our fists, swords that roar, and it is our duty to bring worlds to their knees. Our father, a creature of such power that it hurts to look upon him, strides through our ranks. He aims a sword at the stone walls of a foreign city.
Illuminate them!
Mekari is next to me in the battle formation. We march together, pulling on our helms in the same moment. The Crimson King demands that this city fall by sundown. We will make it so. We gather in a chamber the size of a colosseum, listening to Horus Lupercal detail how Terra will die. The tactical analysis is over. We are deep into the speeches now. Some of the War Master's supreme genius in dealing with his fellow warriors has eroded. Once he encouraged the back and forth flow of his warriors' words, giving them a forum for amending battle plans and airing their perspective. Tonight, there is precious little of such even-handed interaction. Horus says much and listens too little. Does he still realize we are all here for our own reasons? That this war means something different to each of us? Hatred seethes beneath his skin, and he believes we all share his grievances. He is wrong. Makari stands to my side, and Ashokai stands at my shoulder. Jeddor carries the company banner, holding it high among so many others. Horus Lupercal speaks with a god's voice and a god's confidence. He speaks of triumph, of hope, and eternal walls falling into dust. I turn to face
Ahriman!
I have cried his name half a dozen times already. He either does not hear or refuses to listen. He raises his arms to the ghost-choked sky, crying out in exultation. Three of our inner circle have ignited in savage pillars of warp fire, unable to brace against the forces being summoned. Two have come apart, crumbling to their component particles as their mortal forms were overwhelmed by Ahriman's careless psychic mustering. To stand with him here is like shouting into a storm. Names are chanted, hundreds upon hundreds of names, but even the others are breaking off the mantras and beginning to stare at one another. I cannot risk summoning a killing flame atop the pyramid. In this nexus of etheric energy, it would kill us all. The power gathering around us beneath the haloed heavens starts lashing in spiteful, coruscating arcs. I've already tried shooting him, but the roaring wind steals the bolts from the air. His ritual, his rubric, is failing. I have prepared for this. Sayern cuts the air to my right, ripping a wound in the world. Makari is the first through, his bolter leveled at Ahriman. Jeddor follows him, then Voros, Token, and Ryokane.
End this madness!
Makari calls to our commander, shouting above the wind. An arc of lashing, uncontrolled etheric force whip-cracks through the side of the pyramid, shaking the platform beneath our feet. One of the sorcerers still standing is struck blind. Another is hurled to his knees.
Kill him!
I shout to my men. More arrive through the conduit with each heartbeat.
Kill Ahriman!
Their bolters open up in draconic chorus. Nothing hits. Nothing strikes home. Ahriman screams at the sky. Makari is reaching for him, his gauntleted fingers scarcely a centimetre from our commander's throat, when the rubric is unleashed. Energy spears out from Ahriman's aura, carried by his mournful cry, as at last he realizes he has lost control. And then Makari dies. They all die. Every one of my warriors atop the pyramid's apex platform, beneath the unfamiliar stars of Sortiarius's sky, suddenly falls still. Makari stands silent, his reaching hand dropping on slack joints. I see him standing before me, but no longer feel him there. It is as though I am looking into a mirror and not recognizing the person staring back. Something is there, but it is entirely wrong. My warriors crash to the ground in armored heaps. Keltaran headcrests smashing onto the glass floor, sending cobweb cracks spreading. The light of Makari's T-visor remains active, his head tilted to face me. I walk towards Ahriman with my axe in my hand. Someone, somewhere, calls,
Kion!
There is no true shelter left in the burning city. I hide from the killers as best I can, crouching with my back to the tumble-down wall of a ravaged stellar observatory. Nearby flames lick at the heat sensors at the corner of my retinal display. The only weapon in my hands is a combat blade, used for plunging into armor joints. I lost my chainsword some time ago. My bolter remains maglocked to my hip, ammo-starved and useless. The same visual display that tracks external temperature tells me that I have been out of ammunition for 3 minutes and 40 seconds. As I catch my breath, I feel a cold sliver of unease. This makes no sense. This is Prospero, my homeworld, on the day it died to the fangs and claws of the wolves. This was before Ahriman's failed rubric. This was before we stood in Horus's war council. All of the other memories came in temporal procession, but this one is cast out of its alignment. I turn and suddenly see why. Abaddon is with me. He stands nearby, watching with a commander's patience. He was the one who spoke my name, the wayward warrior I met aboard the Vengeful Spirit with Telemachon and Leor, not the soldier prince of historical record. Patchwork armor gives off a dull gleam as it reflects the firelight. He carries no weapon, yet he does not seem unarmed. Threat flows around him in ways I cannot quite discern. He has a dangerous soul. It shows in his smile, as well as his golden eyes. "Why are you here?" I ask him, keeping my voice down in case my words attract wolves.
"I've been at your side through all of this," he replies. "I witnessed your childhood with Mekari and your years as a legionary of the Thousand Suns. You are only seeing me now."
"Why?"
"Because this memory matters."
He comes to crouch with me. I notice none of the remaining dust clings to his armor as it does mine.
"This memory defines you more than any other moment in your life, Kion."
A man would not need to be a prophet to know that. Here is where my homeworld died. Here is where Gaia first took the form of a wolf. Here is where I took Saeern from the twitching fingers of a Sixth Legion champion. Here is the treachery that forced the Thousand Suns to side with rebels and madmen, against ignorance and deception. Here is where I came within hours of my own death, until Lehor found me in the Ashen Ruins. To say this day defines me above any other is hardly a revelation. Perhaps I should be uncomfortable with Abaddon walking alongside me through my mind. The opposite is true. His presence is calming, his pale curiosity infectious. My tutelary is gone. Dead or lost, I have no way of knowing which. We of the Thousand Suns keep these incorporeal spirit creatures as familiars. Each one was summoned from the calmest tides of the warp and bore us no hostility. They simply drifted nearby, watching and silently advising. This was, of course, the age before we knew what demons truly were. My tutelary called itself Gaia. It was a genderless thing of fractal patterns only visible at sunset, speaking in the sound of wind chimes when it deigned to speak at all. I had not seen it in the hours since the sky caught fire with space wolves' drop pods.
"You keep looking to the west," Abaddon points out. "The city burns no differently there than anywhere else."
"My tutelary vanished there."
"Ah, you're familiar."
"No, not here and now. Before Prospero burned, we called them tutelaries. We did not know what they really were." I say nothing for a time, looking over my many wounds once more. "Why are your eyes gold?" I ask Abaddon. He closes them for a moment, touching his fingertips to them.
"I looked into the Astronomicon for a long, long time, listening to its verses and choruses. The Emperor's light did this to me."
"Does it hurt?" His answering nod hides more than it reveals.
"A little. No one ever said enlightenment came without cost, Kion."
I look back across the burning street, where a city of scholars is dying to the axes and fire of barbarians. A cataclysm that will, in time, educate both legions. How very apt Abaddon's words are.
I hear wolves, he says.
I hear them too. Boots pounding on the white avenue, shattering the marble road. I clutch my knife tighter, waiting, waiting.
How many did you kill that day?
Abaddon asks me. Even if the wolves cannot hear him, I say nothing. They will surely be able to hear me. I hear them draw close, stalking, sniffing the air. That's when I move, rising in a snarl of armored joints and dust-shrouded ceramite. My knife takes the first wolf under the chin, punching up through his throat and into his skull. Bless the Sixth Legion for going to war without wearing their helms. The others are already moving. Chainswords whine and bolters crunch to shoulder guards. Barbaric threats leave the mouths of ignorant fools. Oaths of vengeance, primal promises. You do not understand, I tell them. They leap for me the moment I cast their brother's body aside. That is what kills them. No longer do I seek to control the warp's breath, shaping it into precise applications of psychic force. Now I simply let it flow through me, doing as it will. The closest packmate falls to the ground in a boneless topple, decaying inside his armor. The warp's touch has aged him 1,000 years in the span of a single heartbeat. The second ignites in topaz flame, eating his flesh to the bone without even marking his ceramite. The last of them is less hot-blooded. He keeps his bolter on me. I want to tell him that he is a fool, that he and his legion are to blame for all this. I want to tell him that we are not sinners, and that the power we call upon, the powers that we are being judged and sentenced for using, are only brought forth now in the fight to survive. In raising Prospero, the Space Wolves have left us no choice but to commit the very crime they are punishing us for. He fires before I can speak. A kill shot that does not kill, battered aside from my head with a flare of telekinetic instinct. It isn't enough. He bears me down to the ground, and suddenly nothing matters but the knives in our hands. Mine carves into his armpit, caught fast in servos as well as muscle meat. I am certain his has missed until I feel the pressure of a titan's weight on my stomach. There is no tearing pain when a blade plunges into your flesh. It is a hammer blow, no matter how well you are trained to ignore it and recover. For a moment, I bare my teeth behind my faceplate, shaking the knife impaled in his arm, hoping to sever the muscles and steel his strength. The breath from his dirty smile fogs my eye lenses. He leers down at me with a wolf's stare and a man's grin. Retinal warnings scream of the damage his knife is doing to my insides. Belly wounds are savage. Foulness and poison will leak from wounded intestines and bowels, eventually corrupting healthy flesh and blood, beyond what our gen-enhanced physiology can repair.
Traitor, the wolf breathes down at me.
Filthy traitor.
The first mouthful of blood runs up my throat and over my lips, spilling down my cheeks to pool inside my helm. It steals any hope of reply beyond a strained gurgle. Abaddon still stands nearby. I sense him even if I cannot see him. For a moment of blood-stained desperation, I consider demanding that he help me. The very idea of it turns my gurgling curse into a grin. I do not bother pulling my knife free. My hand crashes against the side of his head, not to break his skull, but clawing for a fistful of his long, greasy hair. It comes free with the sound of ripping paper. Fresh spit flecks my eye lenses as he snarls, but still his weight bears down on me with crushing force. A fist to his head does nothing. And another. And another. On the fourth, I clutch the side of his skull and plunge my thumb into his left eye. The wet crunch is the sweetest sound I have ever heard. He does not cry out or show any pain beyond the way his feral rictus turns to glass. His skull gives a quiet snap, then a louder crack. I am breaking his head apart in my hand, and he refuses to even acknowledge it, no different from a rabid dog with its jaws locked on prey. More blood surges up my throat and runs from my mouth as he cuts me open from groin to sternum. The pain is acid and lightning and fire, but nothing compared to the vicious, sick shame of helplessness. My sight is swimming now, reddened by blood. One-eyed and laughing, the wolf keeps cutting. I keep bringing up blood into my helm. It sloshes against my face, as hot as boiling water. Tiredness covers me in a queasy blanket, and my hand falls from its grip back to the dust. My knuckles clang against his fallen bolter, discarded in the ashes. It takes 3 tries before I clutch it in a sure enough grip, and with trembling fingers I force-feed him the barrel of his own gun. It breaks his teeth on the way in and blows the back of his head apart on the way out. His weight atop me becomes a dead man's embrace. I roll his carcass off, pull the blade from my belly, and disengage my helm to let the blood slap onto the marble avenue beneath me. Pain runs through me in time with my beating hearts.
How long did you remain on the ground? Abaddon asks me.
Not long. Already I try to move, trusting my legionary genetics to cope with the disemboweling wound. A pulse of psychic encouragement sends the process into a quickened dance, setting my flesh to scab and re-knit faster.
Didn't you fight a 6th Legion champion on this day?
Abaddon asks. He follows me down the avenue, his golden eyes shining with amusement at my limp. I nod. Iaric, born of fire. He will find me soon. Very soon.
And how did you beat him with these wounds?
Distraction and pain prevent the answer. Sealing my wounds requires focus. I do not know how long passes before the shout comes. It chills my blood now, just as it did on that distant day. No words, no threats, no promises. Just an ululating howl from the throat of a warrior who demands his foes face him. I turn slowly, made now of aches and wounds that will one day become scars. Before me stands an axe-bearer, a warrior of dirty nobility, wreathed in a cloak of smoke-stained white fur. Fenrisian runes show gold against his warplate's grey. At his side walks a piebald wolf, with its fur cast in mismatching patches of brown and grey. Pink froth coats its maw. Red juice drips from its fangs. The thing is the size of a stallion. Even from here I catch the reek of blood on its breath. Familiar blood. The blood of my brothers and the innocent souls of Tiska. For no reason I can understand, I simply say, "Be gone." I think it's the best my weary mind can muster. The stomach wound is not the first injury I have suffered today. Merely the most grievous, and I doubt there is enough blood left in my body to fill a 6th Legion drinking skull. The wolf lord walks closer. No, he prowls, fluid and fierce like the beast at his side. The axe in his hands is a relic of true beauty. For a weary, weary moment, I think there are worse deaths than one brought about by that blade. And then he makes the mistake that costs him his life.
"I am Iaric, born of fire," he says. "Thirsty is my axe for the blood of traitors."
Crippled or not, I stand taller. The Fenrisian tongue struggles with Gothic, but adds a grim poetry to the words rather than detracting from them. I've always enjoyed their language. To hear a Fenrisian speak is to hear a saga poet threaten to cut your throat. "I am Iskandar Kion, born of the world you are murdering, and I am no traitor."
"Save your lies, for the black spirits that heed them, sorcerer."
He comes closer, smelling my weakness. This will be an execution, not a duel. Above us, the sky chokes on the blackness of the burning city. Bolters are a distant, unending staccato. Pyramids that have stood proudly for thousands of years are shattered and brought down by self-righteous barbarians. Now this warlord comes to me, spitting misguided madness at me under the guise of righteous judgment. I am not a traitor.
Loud and long do the All-Father's words ring, louder and longer than the death prayer of a traitor.
The beautiful axe rises. I do not summon fire from beyond the veil, or beg the spirits to aid me. I look at the warrior who would be my executioner, bridge a conduit between our thoughts, and let my bitterness spill forth from my mind into his. My helpless, cornered, kicked-dog fury takes root in his heart. The warp itself floods through the bond between us, spilling through his blood and bones, breaking him down at the unseeable level of particles and atomic patterns. He does not just die where he stands. I unmake him, pulling him apart down to his very core. He disintegrates within his armor, flesh turning to dust so fast that his shade doesn't even realize his body is dead. His ghost claws at me as it dissolves into the warp's winds. My last sight of his spirit shows the incomprehension across his ethereal features. The last sound he makes is a wrenching scream as he begins to burn in the sea of souls. And then he is gone. His armor totters forwards to crash against the avenue, splitting the marble with a dozen fresh cracks. I lift his axe to use as a crutch. The weapon is called Saeern, according to the runes along its length. I speak a handful of Fenrisian dialects. Saeern means truth. I hear Abaddon laughing, clapping his gauntleted palms together.
Such heroism,
he mocks me with a smile. Any sense of victory is short-lived. The huge wolf bears me to the ground in a tumble of wounds and weak limbs. I have no chance to defend myself. Jaws that could swallow my head whole gouge into my breastplate and shoulder guard. Its fangs go through ceramite like iron knives through silk. The thing's weight upon me is the weight of a rhino troop carrier. Armor comes free in a vicious crack, and bloody flesh rips away with it. I'm too cold, too sore to feel it as fresh pain. And then the wolf stops. It just stops, standing above me with my blood running from its teeth. The creature's flesh ripples beneath the smoke-stained fur. Lacerations peel open, revealing muscles, bones, organs. My eyes are wide open when the beast bursts open above me, raining gore in every direction. Viscera stings my face and burns with the saltiness of boiling seawater on my tongue. The pressure against my chest is gone. A shadow of something ghosts away from me. But for several seconds I can do nothing but stare at the sky, needing time to salvage enough strength to rise. The wolf stands several meters away from me, black where its fur had been grey-white, predatory intelligence in its stare where before there had been only bestial cunning. I know that stare, though I have never seen it before. I know the mind behind it. I know the spirit animating the dead wolf's half-fleshed ghost. Gaia? The wolf stalks to my side, submissive in its greeting. She, and this is the very first time I see Gaia as distinctly, unarguably female, gives a wolfish whine. Gone are the fractal creature's wind-chime words, yet she is too new to this stolen form to communicate in silent speech. I feel a flare of wordless devotion from her as the wolf's heart taints the cold geometry of the demon's spirit. From now on, she will be neither wolf nor demon, but something of both.
A loyal creature, says Abaddon, watching from nearby.
Three thunderhawks scream overhead, their vulture shadows flickering across our armor plating.
It saved your life.
She, I tell him, as I run my blood-stained gauntlets through Gaia's black fur. Not it. She.